A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that creeps up on you when you're not looking. He's standing in front of a 6-high stack of Euroboxes loaded with cast iron cookware. They're tough, they interlock, they're engineered to survive decades in a warehouse. And yet the voice in his head won't shut up, it's still plastic. He's asking us to take that voice seriously. What would the plastics industry say in its own defense? What percentage of plastics actually go to single use versus the durable stuff he's handling? And is the whole make it last argument a genuine sustainability strategy? Or are we just putting lipstick on a pig?
He's right to feel that tension. Here's a man who did the research, found the best available storage system, adopted it, and instead of feeling virtuous, he feels complicit. That's what happens when the entire conversation around plastic has been dominated by images of straws and turtle noses and floating garbage patches. And then you look at a Eurobox and think, wait, this isn't going anywhere for 20 years. Is that better or is it just slower?
The timing on this question is sharp. The OECD just updated their projections. Global plastic waste is on track to nearly triple by 2060, with half of it still heading to landfill. The policy response everywhere has been single-use bans. Straws, bags, cutlery. But nobody's standing at a podium talking about the plastic we designed to last forever. Is that a solution we're overlooking, or a distraction we're being sold?
Let's start with what Daniel's actually holding. A Eurobox is built to a standard called VDA 4500, the German automotive industry standard that specifies exact external dimensions, 600 by 400 millimeters at the base, with modular heights that stack in precise increments. These things are injection molded from polypropylene or high-density polyethylene, recycling codes 5 and 2, and the spec sheets brag about impact resistance, UV stabilization, chemical resistance. They're designed for 10 to 20 years of daily abuse in automated warehouses. Nobody's pretending they'll biodegrade.
Which is almost refreshing. Nobody's marketing a Eurobox as green. They're marketing it as indestructible. The sustainability argument, if there is one, is buried in the engineering. It's durable by design, not by marketing claim.
That's the fork in the road. The plastics industry has two faces. One is the disposable water bottle, designed to be used for 15 minutes and then persist for 4 centuries. The other is the Eurobox, same polymer chemistry, radically different lifetime. If you're going to judge plastic as a material, you have to judge it across both use cases. And the industry will happily tell you that durable applications are the responsible ones.
Here's the thing Daniel's really poking at. Is that a genuine sustainability position, or is it a convenient argument from an industry that knows single use is under siege and needs a respectable narrative? We're not the problem. We make the good plastic.
I think the honest answer is, it's both. And the only way to separate the genuine case from the greenwashing is to look at the numbers. How much plastic actually goes to single use versus durable applications? What does a life cycle analysis really show when you compare a Eurobox to cardboard or wood or metal? And where does the argument fall apart?
Let's do that. Let's take the industry's best case seriously, and then let's see where it cracks.
The scale question first. According to the OECD, single-use plastics account for roughly 40% of total plastic production globally. That's packaging, mostly. Films, wrappers, bottles, containers used once and discarded. The durable goods sector, everything from Euroboxes to car bumpers to PVC pipes, makes up the other 60%. But that 60% is spread across products with lifetimes ranging from a few years to several decades. The waste crisis is overwhelmingly driven by the 40% that's designed to be temporary.
When Daniel looks at his Eurobox stack and feels guilty, he's holding the wrong category of plastic. The stuff choking landfills and oceans is not the polypropylene tote that'll outlive his cast iron pans.
And the industry knows this. If you talk to polymer producers, Borealis or LyondellBasell, they'll point out that polypropylene and HDPE are not inherently toxic materials. In solid form, they're stable, they don't leach, they're highly recyclable at the molecular level. The problem isn't the polymer, it's the collection and sorting infrastructure. And durable goods actually have an advantage here. They're large, easy to identify, less likely to be contaminated with food waste, and they flow through known waste streams like automotive shredder residue or commercial pallet returns.
The industry's opening argument is, don't blame the molecule, blame the system. And if you're going to use plastic at all, use it in applications where it stays in service for decades and then gets recycled. That's not nothing.
It's not nothing, but it also conveniently sidesteps a few things. Let's talk life cycle analysis, because this is where the industry's argument gets its teeth. A study by the Danish Environmental Protection Agency back in 2017 compared reusable plastic transport packaging to single-use corrugated cardboard over 100 trips. The reusable plastic had 30 to 50% lower climate impact, lower carbon emissions, lower water consumption, lower overall environmental burden, provided it actually made those 100 trips.
100 trips is the key phrase. That's the assumption that makes the math work.
In an industrial setting, 100 trips is conservative. A Eurobox in a closed-loop distribution system, like an automotive parts supplier shipping to an assembly plant, might make 500 trips before retirement. At that point, the per-use environmental impact is a rounding error compared to cardboard. But that math only holds in a system where the box comes back. If it gets lost, if it gets thrown in a dumpster at the end of a supply chain, the equation collapses.
That's the catch Daniel's sensing. The Eurobox is a sustainability win inside a closed industrial loop. But Daniel's not a warehouse. He's a guy in an apartment with cast iron cookware. His box isn't making 100 trips. It's sitting in a closet for 20 years and then... what? There's no take-back program for consumers. When that box finally cracks, it goes in the bin.
That's where the lipstick on a pig critique lands hardest. Environmental advocates make a fair point, promoting any plastic use in trenches, fossil fuel infrastructure. The International Energy Agency has identified plastics as the fastest growing source of oil demand. Even if your Eurobox lasts 20 years, the feedstock came out of a refinery. The molding plant runs on grid power. And at end of life, that box is still polypropylene. It'll sit in a landfill for 500 years unless someone actively recycles it.
The industry's sustainability argument has a built-in asterisk the size of a shipping container. It works if and only if. The collection and recycling infrastructure exists to close the loop. For industrial users, it sometimes does. For consumers, it almost never does.
That brings us to the uncomfortable reality Daniel's really getting at. He said it plainly, for a substantial part of the world, namely supply chain and warehousing, there simply isn't a good alternative. He's right. And that's not an industry talking point, that's a material science reality.
Walk me through that. Why can't we just make Euroboxes out of something else?
Because the Eurobox isn't just a box, it's a standard. VDA 4500 specifies exact external dimensions that interface with automated storage and retrieval systems, pallet racking, conveyor belts, and robotic picking arms. These systems are calibrated to sub-millimeter tolerances. Change the material, and you change the dimensional stability under load.
If I try to make a cardboard box to VDA 4500 specs, what happens?
Corrugated cardboard doesn't have the structural rigidity for high-stack warehouse loads. Cardboard also absorbs moisture, which changes its dimensions. In a humid warehouse, your 600mm box becomes 602, and suddenly it doesn't fit in the automated rack.
What about wood?
Wooden crates are heavier, they splinter, they don't interlock with the precision of injection-molded plastic, and they're not compatible with automated handling systems. Splinters jam conveyor belts. Wood also off-gasses and can contaminate sensitive goods. And weight matters enormously. A wooden crate that weighs twice as much as a plastic tote doubles the fuel cost of every shipment. Metal bins are expensive, heavy, prone to denting, and they corrode. An aluminum or steel tote that gets dented no longer fits the rack. In a 24/7 automated warehouse, a single jammed bin can stop an entire picking line. The downtime cost makes metal a non-starter for most applications.
Plastic isn't just the cheapest option. It's the only material that meets the functional spec.
And that's the part of this conversation that doesn't get enough air. We talk about plastic as though it's always a choice, as though consumers are just lazy or cheap, and if they cared more, they'd buy the wooden alternative. But in industrial storage, the alternative doesn't exist. The choice isn't between plastic and something better. It's between plastic and plastic.
Which is why Daniel's prompt has that edge of frustration. He's not asking us to absolve him of guilt. He's pointing at a structural lock-in that makes individual consumer choice almost meaningless in this category.
The lock-in goes deeper than the boxes themselves. The entire global supply chain is built around these standards. Automated warehouses represent billions of dollars of installed infrastructure, pallet racking, conveyor systems, robotic pickers, all designed around the dimensional stability and weight characteristics of polypropylene and HDPE totes. Retooling that infrastructure for a different material would be a multi-decade, multi-trillion dollar project. Nobody's volunteering to fund that.
The plastics industry's strongest argument isn't really an argument at all. It's a fact on the ground. We built the modern supply chain around plastic, and now we're stuck with it. The sustainability question isn't, should we use plastic? It's given that we're using plastic, how do we minimize the damage?
That reframing matters, because it moves the conversation from individual guilt to systemic design. Daniel standing in front of his Eurobox stack feeling bad, that's the consumer trap. He's been told to vote with his wallet for sustainability, but in this category, there's no sustainable option on the ballot. The Eurobox is the best available choice. But best available is not the same as good.
That's a phrase that's going to echo through this whole episode. Best available is not the same as good.
The industry knows this too, which is why the smarter players are investing in what they call circular polyolefins. Borealis has a program called BorCycle, mechanical recycling of polypropylene, grinding up old products into feedstock for new injection molded goods. Lyondell Basel has a similar program. The vision is a closed loop. Take back old Euroboxes, grind them up, mold new ones. Same polymer, same spec, virgin quality performance from recycled feedstock.
Does that actually work at scale?
Polypropylene can be mechanically recycled multiple times without significant degradation if it's kept clean and sorted by type. The challenge isn't the chemistry, it's the logistics. You need collection points, reverse supply chains, sorting facilities. For industrial users running closed-loop pallet pools, this already happens. There's no BorCycle bin at your local recycling center.
We're back to the infrastructure gap. The industry has the technology to make durable plastic genuinely circular. What it doesn't have is a way to get the boxes back.
That's the uncomfortable conclusion Daniel's question points toward. The Eurobox isn't the villain in this story. It's arguably the least bad version of plastic we've got, but that doesn't make it a solution to the plastic crisis. It makes it a holding pattern, a way to minimize damage while we wait for the systemic changes that would actually close the loop.
The systemic changes aren't about better polymers. They're about producer responsibility laws, recycled content mandates, and collection infrastructure that works for consumers, not just for automotive supply chains.
Which is where we should go next. Because life cycle analysis only tells part of the story, the real reason we're stuck with plastic Euroboxes isn't material science, it's infrastructure. And that infrastructure didn't happen by accident. Before we go there, I want to sit with the industry's own framing for a minute. Because Daniel asked a very specific question, how would the plastics industry respond to that voice in his head? And the answer reveals exactly why this debate is so slippery.
The industry has a response ready to go.
It's practically laminated. The argument runs like this. Plastic is not a single product category. It's a family of materials with wildly different use cases. Conflating a single-use water bottle with a Eurobox is like conflating a paper napkin with a library book. Same raw material, completely different relationship to time.
They'd say the environmental movement has trained everyone to see the napkin and ignore the library.
That's the line. Plastics. Europe has been pushing this framing hard. They call it durable by design. The idea is that polymers in long-life applications are a net environmental positive because they displace more resource-intensive materials and amortize their production footprint over decades. A Eurobox that lasts 20 years spreads its manufacturing emissions across thousands of use cycles. A cardboard box amortizes across one.
The Eurobox, in their telling, isn't just not the problem, it's the solution. It's the responsible face of plastic.
That's where we have to decide. Is the Eurobox a hero or a villain? Because the answer isn't obvious. If you judge it by per-use environmental impact against the available alternatives, it wins. If you judge it by what happens at end of life in a system with 9% recycling rates, it loses. The same object can be both things depending on which part of its life cycle you're looking at.
It's a hero inside the warehouse and a villain at the landfill gate.
The plastics industry is betting that most people will stop looking at the warehouse door. That's the greenwashing risk Daniel's sensing. Not that the durability argument is false, but that it's strategically incomplete.
Let's test the industry's math, because amortize across thousands of use cycles. Sounds great until you ask what actually happens to the box at cycle number 1001. The OECD numbers are brutal here. Early 9% of plastic waste gets recycled globally. 22% is mismanaged. That means it leaks into the environment. The rest goes to landfill or incineration.
Those numbers are dominated by packaging. That 40% single-use slice drives the waste crisis. The durable stuff, Euro boxes, car parts, construction plastics, it's a smaller share of the waste stream partly because it stays in use longer. But longer is not forever. Eventually, every Euro box becomes waste, and when it does, it enters the same system with the same 9% recycling rate.
The per-use math works beautifully for trip number 57. What it doesn't account for is trip number 501. When the box is cracked and nobody knows where to send it.
That's the Danish EPA study's quiet caveat. The 30 to 50% climate advantage over cardboard assumes the plastic makes all 100 trips and then gets recycled. If it gets landfilled after 70 trips, the advantage shrinks. If it gets incinerated, the carbon math flips. Burning polypropylene releases about 3 kilograms of CO2 per kilogram of plastic. Suddenly, your durable hero is a net emitter.
How many trips does a Eurobox actually need to make before it beats cardboard on carbon?
The break-even point in most life cycle analyses sits around 20 to 30 trips, depending on the weight of the plastic box versus the cardboard it's replacing. A typical Eurobox weighs about 2 kilograms. A comparable cardboard box might weigh half a kilogram but gets replaced every trip. After 30 trips, you've avoided 15 kilograms of cardboard production and disposal. The plastic box's manufacturing emissions are paid off.
In an industrial loop, the Eurobox passes break-even in the first month. It's not even close.
Not even close. And that's why the industry's confidence isn't entirely bluster. The Fraunhofer Institute did a study for the German automotive industry and found reusable plastic containers reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 60% compared to single-use packaging over a 10-year service life.
Here's where the material science angle gets interesting. You mentioned polypropylene is recyclable at the molecular level. What does that actually mean?
It means the polymer chains in polypropylene can be melted and reformed without breaking down the way some other plastics do. Every time you mechanically recycle PP, you lose a little bit of chain length, which slightly reduces impact strength. But for a Eurobox, where the walls are thick and the structural demands are compressive, not tensile, you can blend recycled content at 50, 60, even 80% and still meet spec. That's not true for a water bottle, where clarity and thin wall strength matter enormously.
The Eurobox is almost ideally suited to circularity from a chemistry standpoint. The polymer doesn't care.
The polymer is practically begging to be recycled. HDPE is the same story. It's one of the easiest plastics to mechanically recycle. The recycling code on the bottom of the box isn't just a label. It's a statement that says, this object is technically recyclable. The failure isn't in the material. It's in everything that happens after the box leaves the warehouse.
Which brings us to the lipstick on a pig side of the argument, because environmental advocates look at this and say, you're telling me a nice story about polymer chemistry while the industry is building new ethane crackers and expanding fossil fuel extraction.
They're not wrong about the trajectory. The IEA has been clear, plastics are the fastest growing driver of oil demand. Not transportation, not power generation. The industry is projecting 4 to 5% annual growth in polyolefin production. That means more refineries, more feedstock extraction, more emissions, regardless of how long the final product lasts.
Even if every Eurobox ever made gets recycled perfectly, the industry's growth trajectory still means more plastic entering the system every year. The durability argument addresses what happens to plastic after it's produced. It doesn't address the production itself.
That's the core of the greenwashing critique. The industry wants the conversation to be about product lifetime and recyclability because those are solvable, technically solvable, problems. What they don't want to talk about is the upstream question. Should we be producing 400 million tons of virgin plastic a year in the first place?
Daniel's Eurobox, for all its engineering virtue, is still part of that 400 million tons. It's a better piece of the problem, but it's still the problem.
Unless, and this is the industry's counter, the alternative is worse. If you banned plastic Euroboxes tomorrow, what replaces them? We already walked through cardboard, wood, and metal. None of them work at scale. So you'd be replacing a recyclable, lightweight, durable material with something heavier, less durable, and possibly more carbon-intensive over its full life cycle.
The environmentalist has to answer a version of the same question Daniel's asking. Is it better to use the flawed material that actually works, or to demand alternatives that don't exist yet?
That's where the conversation gets uncomfortable. Because the honest answer might be, use the plastic, make it last as long as possible, recycle it when it's done, and simultaneously push like hell for the systemic changes that would make non-plastic alternatives viable. That's not a satisfying answer. It doesn't fit on a protest sign.
It's the best available is not the same as good. Problem again. Only now it applies to the entire industrial economy, not just Daniel's storage closet.
The plastics industry knows this puts them in a powerful position. They're not selling an optional consumer good. They're selling the substrate that global supply chains run on. You can't boycott it. You can't substitute it. You can only manage it.
Which is why the response to that voice in Daniel's head isn't stop worrying. It's worry about the right things. The Eurobox itself isn't the problem. The problem is a system that produces plastic without planning for what happens to it after 20 years of faithful service. Life cycle analysis only tells part of the story. The real reason we're stuck with plastic Euroboxes isn't material science, it's infrastructure.
That infrastructure is the part nobody wants to pay for. VDA 4500 isn't just a size specification. It's a physical interface standard that connects to automated storage and retrieval systems where robotic shuttles zip down aisles at 20 kilometers an hour, grabbing totes off racks with sub-millimeter precision. The conveyor belts, the pallet racking, the picking arms, all calibrated to the weight, dimensions, and friction coefficient of polypropylene and HDPE.
The box is a component in a machine the size of a building.
Change the material and you don't just swap out a box. You recalibrate every sensor, every gripper, every conveyor motor in the system. An automated distribution center for a major retailer might have 50,000 totes circulating at any given time. The infrastructure around those totes costs hundreds of millions of dollars. Nobody's ripping that out because someone invented a nice bamboo alternative.
The dimensional stability point is the one that kills most alternatives before they leave the drawing board. Plastic holds its shape.
To the millimeter, a cross temperature ranges from freezing to 40 Celsius in 90% humidity. That's polymer physics. Polypropylene has a coefficient of thermal expansion that's predictable and low enough that a 600 millimeter box doesn't jam in its rack slot between a cold truck bay and a warm picking floor. Try that with an uncoated wooden crate and you'll find out exactly how much a warehouse manager enjoys, unjamming a seized tote at 3 in the morning.
Which brings us to the uncomfortable thing Daniel's really pointing at. He didn't want to buy plastic. He bought the only thing that works. That's not a consumer failure. That's a market failure.
It's worse than a market failure because it's invisible. Walk into any hardware store and you'll see rows of storage bins, flimsy polypropylene, clear polycarbonate, the occasional steel shelf unit. None of it is designed for 100 trips. None of it is standardized. The Eurobox exists in a parallel universe, the industrial catalog, the B2B supplier, the pallet-sized minimum order. Consumers who want durable, standardized, recyclable storage have to go hunting through commercial supply chains that weren't built for them.
Daniel did the research, found the good stuff, and now he's standing there feeling like he cheated on a test he didn't know he was taking. The system asked him to choose sustainably, then handed him a ballot with one name on it.
That's the consumer trap in its purest form. We're told to vote with our wallets. But in whole categories of essential goods, the sustainable option doesn't exist, or it exists only in industrial channels, or it's priced for corporate procurement departments. The Eurobox is the best available choice. Best available is not the same as good.
The industry's response to this trap is, frankly, interesting to watch. They're not ignoring it. Borealis launched something called Borcycle, a mechanical recycling program specifically for polypropylene durable goods. The idea is you take back old Euroboxes and automotive parts, grind them into flake, wash it, sort it by polymer type, and feed it back into injection molding machines. Same polymer, same spec, virgin quality performance.
The technology is sound. Mechanical recycling of polypropylene is one of the few circular processes in plastics. You melt it, filter out contaminants, pelletize it, and it goes straight back into a mold. The energy input is a fraction of virgin production. The carbon savings are real, typically 60 to 80% lower emissions than virgin PP. Borealis has been running this at commercial scale for industrial clients for several years now.
The Eurobox could, in theory, be a closed-loop product. Box gets made, box does 20 years of service, box gets ground up, box gets reborn as a new box. Same polymer, infinite loops.
The catch is the same one we keep running into. Borcycle works for industrial clients who are already running returnable packaging pools. An automotive manufacturer can send a truckload of worn-out totes back to the recycler because they've got a logistics network, volume, and a financial incentive. Those totes are company assets. Daniel has 6 boxes in his apartment. There's no Borcycle collection bin at his local recycling center. There's no reverse logistics pipeline for consumer durable plastics.
The circular economy for durable plastic exists. It just doesn't exist for people.
That gap between industrial circularity and consumer reality is where the whole sustainability argument gets hollow. The industry can point to Borcycle and say, look, we're closing the loop. But the loop only closes for the companies that already have the infrastructure. For everyone else, the box still ends up in the bin.
Leondo Basel has a similar program, right?
And there are smaller recyclers across Europe doing mechanical PP and HDPE recovery. The EU's Packaging Waste Directive is pushing hard on recycled content mandates. By 2030, all plastic packaging in the EU is supposed to contain at least 30% recycled content. That's creating market pull for exactly this kind of recycling. But durable goods like Euroboxes aren't classified as packaging under most regulations, so they fall through the cracks. No mandate, no collection target, no incentive.
The thing that's best suited to circularity, durable, single polymer, easy to identify, is the thing nobody's required to actually make circular.
That's the policy gap in one sentence. We regulate the water bottle that exists for 15 minutes. We don't regulate the Eurobox that exists for 20 years. And when that Eurobox finally cracks, it enters a waste system designed for packaging, not for durable goods. The recycling center knows what to do with a PET bottle. It doesn't necessarily know what to do with a 2-kilogram slab of polypropylene with a VDA 4500 stamp on it.
Which means the thing Daniel's holding might be the most recyclable object in his apartment, and also the least likely to actually get recycled.
That's the paradox, and it's why just buy durable plastic isn't a complete answer. It's a better answer than buy single-use cardboard. But it's not a solution, it's a holding pattern. Where does that leave someone standing in front of a stack of plastic boxes in their garage? Let's get practical. If you have to use plastic, and in storage, you basically do. There are 3 things worth doing.
First one's almost too obvious, but nobody says it plainly. Choose durable, standardized, and recyclable. The Eurobox is a legitimate better choice than flimsy consumer bins that crack in 2 years, or single-use cardboard that disintegrates in a damp basement. Look for products made from a single polymer, polypropylene or HDPE, with recycling codes 502 stamped on the bottom. That stamp matters because it tells the recycling center exactly what they're dealing with. A mixed material bin with metal hinges and a foam gasket is landfill by design.
Single polymer construction is the unsung hero here. No adhesives, no laminates, no multi-material assemblies that can't be separated. Just one plastic, one mold, one recycling stream. That's the difference between something that can be ground up and reborn and something destined for the incinerator.
Second thing, ask your supplier about take-back programs. The circular economy for durable plastics only works if manufacturers are responsible for end of life. Most companies selling Euroboxes to industrial clients already have return logistics. They don't advertise it to consumers because nobody asks. But if you're buying 10 boxes for your garage, ask the question. What do I do with these when they finally wear out? Do you take them back? Even if the answer is no today, enough people asking changes the calculus.
Producer responsibility doesn't happen because companies wake up feeling virtuous. It happens because customers signal demand, and the demand signal for durable plastic take-back is basically non-existent in the consumer market. Be the annoying customer who asks. That's how industrial programs eventually trickle down.
Third one's the hardest to swallow. Recognize the limits of individual action. The real leverage point isn't what you buy. It's industrial policy. Mandates for recycled content in durable goods. Extended producer responsibility laws that make manufacturers responsible for what happens after their products crack. Investment in recycling infrastructure for rigid plastics, not just bottles and film. Those are the changes that would actually close the loop.
Those changes are starting to move, just not fast enough. The EU's Packaging Waste Directive is pushing recycled content mandates, but durable goods like Euroboxes aren't classified as packaging, so they slip through. Closing that regulatory gap, making anything injection, molded from polyolefins, subject to the same circularity requirements as a shampoo bottle, that's a policy fight worth having.
The practical takeaway is a weird three-step. Buy the best plastic you can find. Ask what happens when it dies, and then spend your actual advocacy energy on the systemic stuff, because that's where the tonnage is. Here's the open question I keep coming back to. Is durable plastic a genuine bridge to a circular economy, or is it just a very well-engineered way to delay the inevitable transition away from fossil fuels? Because both readings fit the same facts.
The answer probably depends on whether we build the collection and recycling infrastructure to match. Right now we've got the technology to make polypropylene circular. BorCycle works, the chemistry works, the economics work at industrial scale. What we don't have is the political will to extend that infrastructure beyond factory gates to the rest of us. If that changes, the Eurobox stops being a holding pattern and starts being a model. If it doesn't, we're just making very nice landfill with a 20-year delay fuse.
The fuse is the thing. The industry loves talking about the 20 years. They're quieter about the 500 after that.
The clock is ticking in a direction that makes this more urgent, not less. E-commerce isn't shrinking. Automated warehousing isn't shrinking. The demand for standardized plastic totes is going to keep climbing, and the only real question is whether that plastic comes out of a refinery or out of a grinder. That's a choice we can influence today, through recycled content mandates, through producer responsibility laws, through closing the regulatory gap that lets durable goods slip past packaging rules.
The voice in Daniel's head isn't wrong. It's just aimed at the wrong target. The Eurobox isn't the problem. The problem is a system that's perfectly capable of making durable, recyclable, circular plastic and chooses not to finish the job.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, a geologist surveying Papua New Guinea's remote highlands documented a subglacial lake buried under nearly a kilometer of ice, a body of water roughly the volume of Lake Ontario, that had been completely isolated from the atmosphere for over 300,000 years.
A lot of very old water.
I have questions about how the geologist got there in the 1880s, but I suspect I don't want the answers.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you've got a prompt eating at you the way this one ate at Daniel, email the show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.